Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, and welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. It's Happy Thursday here on the Cross in the Desert, April 30th. Can you believe it? We are through the month of April, and we are blossoming in spring here in Florissant, where my wife and I live, and we're ready to go into the month of May. And you know what that means? Mother's Day, graduation, Memorial Day, the official opening of the pools, really kind of the first real day of summer, just a few weeks away from us. And so I hope that you are having a great Thursday morning. I have a really, really intense program for us today, and I really believe in what I'm doing. I believe that when we raise our voices and make our cries known, and that there are results, that people do listen. And the issue that torments me more than anything in this world is the political mumbo-jumbo issue of the war on women. I hear this still all the time. It was a big mantra during the election of 2012 when Romney was running against Obama. We heard these accusations time and time again from the left about how Republicans oppress women and the issue of women. Well, I really... I'm tired of this subject, but I found a very, very interesting article this morning on The Blaze that addresses this subject in the right perspective, the perspective that I'm going to address it this morning. The real war on women is not about women and their reproductive rights. What it is about the women that you see day and night in the Middle East that are oppressed, killed, tormented, tortured, and abused by men. And this issue is near and dear to my heart. I wrote a little bit about it in my latest book about the case of Rahana Jabari in Iran, who was executed on October 25th of last year for simply defending herself against a rapist. This, to me, is the real war on women. And what I want to take just a minute to quote from The Blaze this morning, an article by Penny Mance. She is the CEO and president of Concerned Women for American Legislative Action Committee. And this is an article from a couple of months ago about the graphic images that we saw about the young Afghan woman who was brutalized by a mob and thrown and killed simply because she was accused of desecrating the Quran. And this article puts in perspective for me the program for this morning. I want to read from the article on the Blaze by Penny Nance, Concerned Women for America, and Penny writes the following. While the radical feminists in the U.S. continue their hiss push for abortions after 5 months of pregnancy, the Blaze reports that another Afghan woman was killed at the hands of the Islamist terrorist extremist. This is what you can really call, quote, a war on women. These stories are not uncommon. Concerned Women for America recently hosted a panel to debunk the left's petty war against women rhetoric, and I am reminded of it while reading these stories, how silly their little arguments look when we read accounts like this. A disturbing video of the disgraceful event shows an angry mob of men beating a woman to death. They kicked and punched her. One jumped on her. Others used clubs and sticks, and another used a bucket, all while the crowd chanted, Allah Akbar. They apparently set her on fire and threw her in the Kabul River in the end. This angry mob scenario reminds me of the class criminals right now in Baltimore. Going on with the story. Why? Because she dared to burn a Quran, or so they allege. The Blaze report says police could not confirm yet whether the woman desecrated the Quran. Whatever the case, there is no justification for this atrocity. But the Quran burning is still important, along with the Allah Akbar chants, because it helps us know that, once again, we are dealing with Islamic extremism and Sharia law. We have to continue to sound the trumpet on this every chance we get. Islamic extremism and Sharia law oppress women. We all know that President Barack Obama won't even call the Islamic State Islamic. So we have little hope that his administration understands the magnitude of the problem women face in Islamic countries around the world. If this happened here, the administration would call it domestic violence or some other nonsense. The White House wouldn't acknowledge that the 21 Coptic Christians beheaded in Egypt were Christians. And don't bother trying to find the word Christian or Islam in the description of their efforts against Boko Haram, which recently pledged allegiance to the Islamic State for some inexplicable reason. Sure, they are both Islamic extremist groups. Boko Haram means Western or non-Islamic education is sin. But that's just a coincidence as far as the Obama administration is concerned. It gets worse. When you talk of Islamic State and Boko Haram, you are talking about the most extreme groups. They are military organizations. But in this video, you can see that the perpetrators are just regular people, not a militia. The problem we have with Islamic extremism is much bigger than Islamic terrorism. It is about an Islamic ideology that has taken hold in a considerable part of the Islamic world. It is actually part of mainstream Islam in several regions in the Middle East, although not here in the U.S. Until we acknowledge this, we won't be able to properly tackle the problem. This is why Concerned Women for America has undertaken a massive effort of prayer for the victims of Islamic ideology. Prayer and love, terror, is an effort to combat this spiritual problem with spiritual weapons. On the fourth Sunday of each month, the more than 500,000 members of the Concerned Women of America around the country and our friends around the world are joining with one spirit to ask for God's intervention. We believe with Benjamin Franklin that God governs in the affairs of men, and he alone can help us fight this great evil. We don't have all the answers, but we know he does. We must only have faith and courage. Would you join us? And that is, of course, Peggy Nance, and we will join her in praying for the oppressed women in the Middle East on the fourth Sunday of every month. And this was in response to that horrible video you saw of the Afghan woman that was killed by a mob. This morning on the Cross in the Desert, I want to take you into the stories of the acid attack victims, of the survivors of forced marriages and honor killings. I want to take you to the forefront of where this really happens. And I think by the end of the day, you will agree with me that this truly is the real war on women. I want to take us to our first interview right now on the EWTN network from about 6 months ago, talking about the Malala situation and the real war on women. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
The world's youngest Nobel laureate visits Philadelphia tonight to pick up yet another award. 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai will receive the Liberty Medal for her work in promoting education for girls. Organizers of tonight's ceremony decided months ago to honor Malala before she won the Nobel Peace Prize. In 2012, a Taliban gunman shot the Pakistani activist because of her vocal support for girls' education. The Liberty Medal is given each year to someone who strives to secure freedom for people around the world. Zainab Al-Zuwaij is the executive director and co-founder of the American Islamic Congress, and Amber Smith is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. We're talking about the war on women, and Amber, you wrote recently criticizing this political phrase, this rhetoric. Why?
Yeah, so Malala absolutely inspires me. Her bravery and the voice that she's given to so many girls in parts of the world that don't have a voice, and her platform that she's given because of the extreme circumstances that she's been in, really reminds me of what the real war on women looks like around the world. And too often in America today, we hear often leftists talking about how there's a war on women raging here in America. And to me, that's just absolutely disrespectful to the women who do face extreme circumstances, anywhere from torture, being sold into sex slavery, separated from their children, acid being thrown in their faces for girls being taught an education. So all of those types of things that they are faced with on a daily basis around the world is what the real war on women looks like.
And Zainab, especially in the Middle East, what does the war on women look like there?
It is really extreme, and it depends on which country you are in. Right now, recently, we saw what's happening in Iraq and Syria, for example, with ISIS having Christian and Yazidi women being sold in the market to slavery. And on the other side, you have the extremist Muslim groups putting pressure on women to be covered from head to toe, to be not leaving the house without a permission of a father or a husband or any male in the family. Women being formed female genital mutilation on them in many countries. And the list goes very long. Beating women in the street, women being stoned, and so on and so forth. These are all violence against women and against their rights.
In light of that, how do you see this, what they call the war on women in America? Mm-hmm. How do you view that?
The comparison is totally different. Here in America, women are protected by law. And we are, as women here in America, taking this for granted, that being protected by law. We have equality laws, we have economic prosperity, we have the right to say, you know, we've been discriminated against. We've been, women been, for example, if she's sexually harassed in a workplace. But women in the Middle East, they do not have that right. They are not being able to gain their rights back. So women organization, myself with the American Islamic Congress, we did a lot of programs in the Middle East in many different countries, in about 14 different countries. And there are many other women organizations locally formed in there or internationally being implementing these programs in these countries, and they have a huge impact on many women's life. It's starting as simple as education. I remember in 2003, 2004 in Iraq, we started an accelerated learning program for children. An 18-year-old woman joined the program. She said, please do not stop me from this, from getting. A few months later, she was reading, and she said, my eyes are open now, and I'm being able to.
Amber, you flew with the American military in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you see what the Christians and Yazidis are going through. What is it like for women there right now?
Well, right now, ISIS, or the Islamic State, or ISIL, all known as those three things. They're kidnapping Christian and Yazidi women who they consider to be infidels. They have, they think they have no human rights, no worth, and they're kidnapping them. They're separating them from their families, and they are basically using them as slaves. Often they are raped, gang raped, tortured. Children are separated from their mothers, and then recent reports are saying that they're being sold on the black market for around $10.
Well, in light of this, perhaps people should reconsider using that line or phrase in political rhetoric.
Absolutely.
War on women. Amber Smith and Zainab Al-Zawaj, thank you both for being with us
tonight.
And until tomorrow, we encourage you.
As you heard there about what's going on in the Middle East, you know very well what ISIS is doing to women. And just recently on The Blaze, Glenn Beck had a program documenting the sale price for women in the Middle East at different ages. It's just unconscionable when you hear about the political back and forth rhetoric in about the war on women here, that we have no concept of what women endure in the Middle East. I want you to hear a little bit about the sale price of women in the Middle East. There is a flyer, of course, in Iraq. It's talking about the sale prices for bounty. It's an actual flyer in the name of God, the most merciful and compassionate. Then it says, it has come to our attention the market value for women in bounty. Spoils of war has witnessed a significant decrease. This has affected the revenues of the Islamic State and the payments for its mujahideen. Therefore, the Treasury found it necessary to set prices for women. All those involved in such a trade must abide by these instructions, and violators will face execution. And this is what's posted at the slave trade price, 75,000 dinars. And it says under commodity, it says price and then commodity. 75,000 dinar, women 30 to 40 years old, Yazidi Christian. That's about $63 according to U.S. currency, and you own her. 100,000 dinars for a woman 20 to 30 years old, Yazidi or Christian, comes out to about $84. 150,000 dinars for a woman 10 to 20 years old, that comes out to about $127 in American money. 50,000 dinars for a woman 40 to 50, around 42. And 200,000 dinars for a child between the ages of 1 and 9. $169. And the fighters can buy them. You know what they use them for? Recreation. So they will buy a child, Glenn Beck writes, bring them up to the war zone and pass them out. And so they just are used for sex, really, between battles. This is the state of our world. This is where we are going. This is what our president is doing, turning a blind eye towards the Middle East. This is what our churches are also doing, turning a blind eye to what's going on. And I'm here to wake us up. The real war on women. I want you to hear this interview just recently on the Sean Hannity program about this war. Let's listen.
We invited a representative from the Arizona chapter of CARE on this program tonight. They declined our request. They did provide us with the following statement saying, quote, American Muslims join people of conscience of all faiths in condemning any form of domestic violence or gender inequality as violations of Islamic beliefs. If anyone mistreats or abuses women, they cannot seek refuge in Islam. Islam mandates that consent of both parties is required before marriage can take place. Forced marriage is an issue of un-Islamic cultural practices, not of faith. Here now with reaction from the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, author of the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, Dr. Zudi Jasser is back with us. 3,000 cases a year. This is not unique, nor is it unique in countries that practice Sharia, is it?
It isn't. And, you know, this horrific, horrific case of this poor girl and the conspiracy of the families involved, you know, certainly it's not the Islam that I know or any of the Muslims I know. But the bottom line is that we have to look at this as a community, that it's the tip of the iceberg. This case in its extreme teaches us. I mean, it's not only this poor girl. Noor al-Maliki was killed by her father here in Phoenix. There was Aya al-Taimi, who was also abused and tied up in her house here in Phoenix by her family because she was dating beating and doing things that dishonored the family. And if you look at honor abuse and honor killing, it is a symptom of a bigger disease of women not having bodily autonomy and being treated as second and third class, if that, individuals that don't have equality. And that comes from cultures and institutions like Saudi Arabia, Al-Azhar University, and others that teach that women are the property and owned by men rather than equal, like we learn in the West.
Honor killings, forced marriages, genital mutilation, this is all happening. In some countries under Sharia, the men can marry, up to four women, in some cases more. Women don't have that right, or needing, you know, multiple male eyewitnesses for rape. This is just a reality. And when I bring some of these topics up, people are somewhat reluctant to talk about it. I felt the guest that we just played earlier, Ms. Al-Sharif, was under a little bit of duress in terms of that interview, because when you look at the laws of Saudi Arabia, they differ from what it is that she was saying, do they not?
Absolutely, and I'll tell you, you know, the solution to this is empowering Muslim women in America and in the West, because the Muslim women you speak to that are trying to change the Middle East will be put in jail and in prison. I mean, this poor Al-Sharif lady was put in jail when she tried to have a Facebook page about driving freely. Raif al-Badawi is serving a sentence, who has an organization like mine, because he talks about women's rights and equality and is being flogged in front of mosques by the Saudi government.
So you agree with, look, I'll put up on the screen, for example, women are not allowed to drive, as she experienced in her life. Women do need male guardians and their permission to leave the house. You know, the same, we have similar problems in other countries. Kuwait, women don't have the right to become prosecutors or judges. No laws prohibiting domestic violence. The UAE, same thing. Men can legally discipline their wives with physical abuse, and they also need a male guardian to conclude a woman's marriage contract. And if you go to Oman and Qatar and Algeria, Brunei, and their women, marital rape is not considered a crime in those countries. So this is we have an issue of a real war on women. My question is, as you watched Ms. Al-Sharif, do you feel she was unwilling to explain the truth of life for women in Saudi Arabia for fear of reprisal?
It has to be that way, because bottom line is, Sean, anyone who speaks the truth in Saudi Arabia will end up in jail and be flogged ultimately, and that's what happens. So she had to march that line where she talked about wanting to work, talked about wanting to drive, getting those incremental changes, and that's why you have revolutions. The only thing that'll change this misogynistic culture of mafia run by men and of the organization, it's not only Saudi Arabia, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is 56 countries of misogynistic run societies of men where women don't have rights that are equal, and Islam can't be reformed into the modern age because they won't allow it, because they don't want to see these revolutions of women and modernity happen. And that's why we have to give them economic independence, and we have to work in the grassroots to allow this reform to happen. And unfortunately, if she's being interviewed from Saudi Arabia, she'll try to push that line, and then she'll blame the West and other things, because that's the talking point that the government will allow her to say.
And liberal women in America are more concerned and rarely speak out about this, but they talk about who's going to pay for birth control, $9 a month, or Mitt Romney has resumes of women in binders, and that's a war on women, and they are utterly silent here. But Zuhdi, good to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Sean Hannity, for bringing to light this very, very important issue. And he was, of course, going through the situation about women in Saudi Arabia and enumerating the various, various situations that they endure. And then talking about the liberal war on women here, you never hear well-known feminists stand up on a platform and speak out for the women in the Middle East. I have yet to see any well-known feminist. And of course, the leading feminist, Hillary Clinton, is receiving foundation money from countries that oppress women. So she can't be the champion of women's rights. I've had sound bites on my program where Hillary makes no bones about her being the champion for women's rights. But when it comes to being confronted about why her foundation, the Clinton Foundation, is allowing money to flow to them in their foundation from countries like Saudi Arabia that oppress women, she has no real answer except to say, you know our heart and you know what we stand for. Well, no, Hillary, we don't know your heart, and we certainly do know what you stand for, and it's certainly not for the rights of women as you claim that you do. I have here in my hands the first few pages of my new book, Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom, and it should be out this August, God willing. But I wanted to share with you this morning the preface I wrote to this book because it puts in context what we're talking about, the war on women. Now, I have always written in support of Iranian women and will continue to do so, but I just felt the need to go to Pakistan with my newest book to talk about these issues that we're speaking about this morning on the radio, and that is honor killings, forced marriages, female genital mutilation. That needs to be addressed as well. And one of my best friends that has been on my program that has been such a support and such a strong voice for the rights of women is Zainab Khan. She's a human rights activist from the documentary Honor Diaries, and in my preface, I quoted from her some excellent quotes that will help us to understand what is going on in the Middle East. She writes, "Cultural acceptance does not mean accepting the unacceptable. It's about time we put an end to laws and norms that support the violence perpetrated against women in the name of culture or religion." Exactly right. And Zainab, a little bit later on, Raheel Raza will be here for an interview that I had found about her from a few years ago on this topic. She is originally from Pakistan, and she understands what's going on there. And she is one among many, including Zainab, that are working hard to be a voice for these women and also to do something to implement a change of these laws, which is very, very difficult. If the laws are not changed in Pakistan, in this culture, then women will continue to die and be oppressed in the name of honor. But what I wanted to do right now is share with you what I wrote in the beginning of my new book, Prisoner of Her Culture. This is the preface. Farzana Parveen was guilty of breaking her family's, quote, code of honor. At 25, she was now pregnant and had bravely decided to go against the wishes of her family by marrying a man of her own choice. Accused of abduction by her family, Farzana arrived at the courthouse in Lahore to defend her husband. 20 of her family members were waiting, and after her arrival, they fired gunshots and began beating her. The violence quickly escalated, and they began throwing bricks at her. In just a matter of moments, Farzana lay dead in a pool of blood, brutally stoned to death in broad daylight before a frightened crowd of onlookers. Asia Bibi hasn't seen her husband and children in more than 5 years. Appeal after appeal has been turned down by the Lahore High Court as Pakistan continues to uphold the death sentence against Asia for blasphemy. Asia lives in a country where Islamic extremists are extremely harsh against Christians and oftentimes uses the blasphemy law against them with discriminatory motives. In June of 2009, Asia was busy working with a group of Muslim women harvesting berries. She was accused of drinking from the same water bowl as them, which is considered unclean because she is a Christian. A brief confrontation ensued, and Asia was accused of insulting the Prophet Muhammad, which is punishable by death in Pakistan. Both Farzana and Asia are victims of an unjust system of oppressive laws that discriminates against women in Pakistan. Honor killings, public stonings, and acid attacks happen far too frequently in a country where the wishes of a family are elevated above human choices. The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan documented more than 913 honor killings in 2013, 99 of them committed against minors. Human life is not upheld and respected by the law, who too often turn their backs and turn a deaf ear to the cries of the oppressed. In 2014, a powerful documentary film entitled Honor Diaries broke the silence. It became a voice for the rights of women in Muslim-majority countries where the gruesome acts of female genital mutilation and honor killings take place. Muslim activist women bravely took to the public platform denouncing these horrible practices and calling for a reform to all of the unjust laws. One of the participants in the film, Zainab Khan, has been a frequent guest on my radio program, The Cross in the Desert. Zainab engages in public speaking and uses her talents in painting as a vehicle for promoting what she calls visual activism. She is a gifted human rights activist and artist, courageously promoting gender equality, standing up for the rights of oppressed women in the Middle Eastern cultures that suffer under quote-unquote male domination. In my previous publications, I have taken up the cause of speaking out for the oppressed women in Iran. After watching Honor Diaries, I feel compelled to take up the cause of Pakistani women. I have shared my radio program and books with my Facebook friends all over the world of the internet in order to be a voice for the voiceless. There is a risk in breaking the silence. The brave women of Honor Diaries have put their lives and reputations at risk in order to rescue women from becoming more victims and statistics in the headline news. I join with the brave women of Honor Diaries in my latest publication to bring awareness to the plight of women living in Pakistan. If we fail to speak out, there will be more women like Farzana and Asia whose lives will be tragically altered by societies that exalt honor over choice. The time is short, and there is an urgent need to speak out now. The Bible commands us to be a voice for the voiceless, quote, "Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Ensure justice for those being crushed. Yes, speak up for the poor and helpless and see that they get justice," quote unquote, Proverbs chapter 31, verses 8 through 9. Well, join me in this cause. I am really, really excited about the new book that I'm writing. I'm right now at about the end of writing chapter 2 and going to begin chapter 3 this weekend. Forced marriage is one of the issues I deal with in my book, and I want you to hear now the testimony of someone in the UK that was able to escape a forced marriage. Here is her story. Let's listen.
I knew what the word honor was from a very early age. I knew what I could do and what I couldn't do, and if I stepped out of line, there'd be consequences. I always believed I'd have an arranged marriage, therefore I always thought I'd have a choice in it. I knew my parents would choose him, and I thought, well, if they choose him and I like him, then I'll say yes. Then it came to the point when I was 17 years old, introduced to him with family around him, obviously not being allowed to be alone with him. And my father said, what do you think of him? And obviously there's no chemistry there whatsoever. So I said, no. And my father said, I'd best get used to the idea because I was going to marry him whether I liked it or not. I'd been taken out of school from the age of 13. And I thought, well, where will I go? What will I do? I felt like I had no choice but to go through with it. And also the threat from my father, the fear, because he said if I thought about running away, he would find me and kill me and go to prison rather than me bring dishonour onto the family. I went through the Indian wedding. That was 4 days of surreal atmosphere. I felt like I wasn't there at all. I was there in body but not in spirit. And that night I was shipped off with a total stranger, a total strange family. And my mother had said to me, it's your duty as a daughter. You have to obey what his family say, what he says. You're now his property. It is your duty to do whatever he tells you to. So that night I was given some milk to drink by his family. And they said it'll help me. And I'm thinking, help me with what? It made me drowsy. To this day, I believe it was drugged. That night I was raped by my husband. And this abuse continued for about 8.5 years of my life. I thought I'd have children because I thought if I have children, I'll have somebody to love and somebody to love me back. But I was miscarrying, so I miscarried 3 times. And it was actually on my 3rd miscarriage, I sat up in the hospital bed and I thought, I don't want to die. I want to live. And it's about time for change. And it was just, that's it, a light bulb moment where I thought, I'm going to leave. I don't know how I'm going to do it just yet, but I'm going to leave. It took me 3 months of planning to the point where I destroyed everything with my national insurance number, my bank statements, everything with my name on it in the house, because I'd often seen cousins who had tried to run away. If they left something behind, they would trace them. The day before I went to the police station and I said to the police officer at the front desk, I said, I'm going to be leaving. I will be reported a missing person by my family and my husband. They will report the car stolen. I'm here to let you know, don't waste police time, and I'm going of my own free will. And my family did report me missing. I went back to education. I found work. I found a place to live. And really went back to education, which was one thing I wanted to do, and got 2 diplomas and made many friends in London and moved on with my life. I work for the police currently to help young people, old people, young women and men to come through the issues, make them safe, and go through the, I can explain the issues of how we can help them, what we can do, how we can protect their name, how we can change identities if that's what they need, how we can protect their national insurance numbers. For people that are going through it, I'd say to them, there is help out there. You know, seek help. Seek help from places like the Forced Marriage Unit. Seek help from the police. If the frontline officer doesn't understand the issues, ask to speak to a senior officer. Ask, you know, there's refuge provision available and we can make you safe as possible. You can come through it the other end. And it's important to know what you're going through. You're not alone.
As you heard the emotional confession of this young girl who escaped the horrors of a forced marriage, and she's also saying there is hope for young girls if they know where to find it. I want to hear, want you to hear one more example of a forced marriage of a young Muslim girl and the consequences that she suffered for refusing it. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Right now, new at 6, a Hollywood mother is facing charges after police say she burned her teenage daughter with a hot knife. It was reportedly to punish the 17-year-old for talking to a boy that she met online.
Hard to believe the girl's parents took that as an act of defiance because they had an arranged marriage for the girl. CBS 4's Joan Murray has more on what's being called an act of honor violence.
The devout Muslim teenager who attends South Broward High came on police radar in January after a classmate reported she had 3 burns on her arms.
She was brought to me and I was told that her mom and her dad had burned her. And because she was communicating with a young boy via the internet.
Somia Lee, who runs South Florida-based No More Tears, an advocacy group, explained how the teen became a victim of so-called honor violence. She says the girl had been communicating with a 20-year-old Muslim man in Yemen for the past year, and that horrified her parents.
So it's not specific to just the Islamic culture. It takes place in various cultures. What that means is that if you are unmarried, you're not allowed to have a boyfriend, you're definitely not allowed to have premarital sex. And if you are to do so and engage in something like that, then your mother and your father and your brother have a right to hurt you.
According to a Hollywood police report, the girl's mother had put a knife on the stove, heating the metal on the knife and placing it on the child's arms. That mother, Sahar Tabit, was arrested on 3 counts of child abuse and released on bond. At the family's West Hollywood home, the girl's grandparents, who speak little English, downplayed the whole incident.
She's fine, you know.
She's fine.
She's okay.
I think she liked communicating with him. She liked him. The boy actually called the house and tried to ask the father for her hand in marriage, but the father was not open to it because they had already arranged her marriage to her cousin.
We're told the teenager is living with a family friend and has returned to school. It's unclear whether she continues to communicate with the man who caused her all the trouble. In Hollywood, Joan Murray, CBS 4 News.
This is typical of thousands of cases, and this is why in my new publication, which will be available prayerfully in August, A Prisoner of Her Culture, I talk about the issue of forced marriage and the horrors of it. Now, I want to tell you something that's really exciting to me from someone who knows about the horrors of forced marriage, and that is Jasvinder Sanghera. She's from a documentary film, just one of the most powerful ones I've seen, Honor Diaries. And she's here in the United States to make awareness of not only forced marriage, but to create a national day of memory for women and girls killed in the name of honor. Now, this is a petition that is up on my Facebook page. This is a very, very great idea. It's a powerful idea to create a national day of memory for women and girls killed in the name of honor. So I want to take the time to read this to you. In the U.S., honor violence is a crime that goes unnoticed and unrecognized. Women and girls are beaten, burned with acid and murdered right under our noses, but it is all too often overlooked. Our first attempt to spread awareness about such horrific human rights abuses was the creation of our award-winning documentary film, Honor Diaries. Now we have teamed up with Jasvinda Sanghera from Karma Nirvana, UK, to wake up the U.S. by petitioning for a National Day of Memory for those victims who have been killed in the name of honor. Karma Nirvana has succeeded in creating a National Day of Memory on July 14th, and our hope is that we can create one on the same date in solidarity with the UK. A family can feel that their honor is tarnished by their daughter acting or dressing too Western, having rumors spread about her, refusing to participate in a forced marriage, and as we've sadly seen, even for merely looking at a boy. Contrary to popular belief, honor violence does not just happen overseas. In the last several years alone, we have seen honor killings in the United States make the news and shock the nation. According to a report by Phyllis Chesler, there are 33 known victims that have been murdered for honor in North America, including right here in St. Louis, where I live. 16-year-old Palestinian Tina Issa was murdered by her Palestinian father with the aid of his wife. Her parents were dissatisfied with her westernized lifestyle. Amina and Sarah Saad, two teenage girls from Texas, were killed allegedly by their Egyptian father, who is still at large. In Arizona, Noor Elamaki, age 20, was killed by her father, an Iraqi immigrant, because she had refused an arranged marriage. Waheed Ala Muhammad stopped his 19-year-old sister Fazia outside of their home in New York because she wore immodest clothing and behaved too Western. Please help us to leave a legacy and make July 14th a National Day of Memory for women and girls killed in the name of honor. If these victims are not remembered, we cannot hope to put an end to such horrific crimes against future generations of women and girls. And this is a great effort by Jasvinda Sanghera, who's here in the United States. She's from Karma Nirvana, her foundation that helps those trapped in forced marriages. She's also appeared in the documentary Honor Diaries. She's here to create this National Day of Memory. I think this is an incredible idea. This petition is up on my page. I'm going to repost it today so that you can sign it to see that these women are not forgotten. That's very, very important. Now, we've been talking about forced marriage, and I want to take you to last year at this time when a Pakistani woman, a pregnant woman, was publicly beaten and stoned because she chose to marry someone other than what her family had designated for her. Actually, I talk about this in the preface of my book that I just read you. Her name is Farzana Parveen, and let's take a moment to remember her horrible, horrific story.
Farzana Iqbal was 25, pregnant, and authorities believe murdered by her own family. In one of the few images we have of the episode, we can see her husband's grief. We do not see the anger that police say led about 20 people, including her father and brothers, to put a crude noose around her neck and smash bricks into her skull. Police say she had refused to marry a cousin her family had chosen and eloped instead. They say that cousin was among her killers. Pakistan is one of many nations that call that kind of murder an honor killing because she allegedly brought shame upon her family. The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan says more than 800 women were killed that way last year. So-called honor killings are widely blamed on the most extreme forms of fundamentalist Islam, but activist Farzana Bari suggests another reason.
I think honor killing has nothing to do with religion. I think it's all about patriarchy. It's about all about men control over women's bodies. It's all about male domination in culture and tradition.
Lahore, where the murder was committed, is one of Pakistan's largest cities, not the kind of remote village where honor killings are considered more common. In fact, the killing might have gone unreported had it been committed in Iqbal's home village. Even in the big city, in broad daylight, Bari says the killers probably never gave much thought to who might see them.
Many people will just you know, they will watch, they will not interfere because it's essentially considered as if women belong to men and it must be a private affair and people will not intervene. And unfortunately, police also has that kind of a mindset.
In this case, police said they arrested Iqbal's father, who admitted to the killing and expressed no regret. Search warrants are out for the others. Jonathan Mann, CNN.
It's just unthinkable that this goes on, but these are the laws in Pakistan that must be changed, and families must be held accountable. A lot of times, the local authorities will kind of turn a deaf ear to men. They get a pass. Somehow they are allowed in many cases to do what they want to do because this is a tribal conflict or a family conflict, and they kind of walk away allowing it to happen. These laws must be confronted and must be changed. As I mentioned to you, one of the guests on my program, Zainab Khan from the Honor Diaries documentary, just recently participated in an ABC special talking about the horrific crime of female genital mutilation. Now, this is featured a lot in the documentary Honor Diaries, and I want to just take a moment to just establish what is going on against the war on women, and this is one of the most horrific crimes in the war on women. Nafis Tio of Guinea knows what the real war on women looks and feels like. When she was a child, she was awakened early in the morning when it wasn't yet light out. The older women made her and other girls leave the village. We lined up, and they took us one by one. When it was my turn, one woman, very old and heavyset, grabbed me and blindfolded me. She made me lay down on the mat, and someone grabbed one of my legs while another person grabbed the other. Then someone cut me. It was the most terrible pain, and I struggled hard, though I could not get away from the grasp of the old woman. After cutting me, they used a sticky substance to glue me together so that I would heal closed. Afterward, we were told not to cry, but all I could do was cry. Nafis Tio was subjected to female genital mutilation, FGM, a horrific practice that has affected more than 140 million women and girls worldwide. Most people think that it only happens in distant lands, but no longer. It's happening to girls right here in the United States, and it's on the rise. Estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention indicate that at least 150,000 to 200,000 girls in the United States are at risk of being forced to undergo FGM. According to the census data from 2000, the number of girls and women in the United States at risk increased by 35% from 1990 to 2000. Activists say those numbers continue to rise, and more current statistics need to be gathered. There is no 2010 data. In 2000, states with the highest number of affected girls included California, New York, New Jersey, Virginia, Maryland, Minnesota, Texas, Washington, and Pennsylvania. And this is from an article by D.C. McAllister, July 30th, 2014, from the Federalist, D.C., for your contribution to the war on women. Another feature of my new book is the horrible acid attacks. Just this past fall, there was acid attacks against women in Iran in the city of Isfahan, simply because they were wearing their hijab improperly. And men on motorcycles would lure women to turn down their window of their car, asking for directions. And as soon as the woman would turn down her window, the man would throw acid in her face. Well, this is horrific. This is beyond belief. But there is some hope for acid attack victims in Pakistan. And we're going to hear this special report right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
This is Bushra. She looks like she does because of greed, because of anger, because of evil. Her in-laws demanded money after a family wedding. She had nothing to give. They took the revenge with acid.
They tied me up from behind and then my mother-in-law pulled me like this. Then they put a cloth on a stick. dipped it in acid, and my husband rubbed one side of my face. His uncle snatched it and rubbed it on the other side of my face, and he also put it in my mouth. Then after that, I could not stay awake and lost consciousness.
Now 34, she hasn't seen her children since the attack 15 years ago. She's gone through 28 operations. She would like to be a beautician and is training at a salon in Lahore. It's run by Musarat Misbah, who decided to help acid burn victims after a chance encounter.
And she moved her veil, and I saw a woman without a face. I saw a girl whose there was no nose, eyes were gone. She had from chin to the neck contracture. That means she just couldn't move her neck also. And I just sat down because I thought there was no life in my legs, you know. I just said, what happened? And she said that she's been thrown acid by her own family members, her husband or in-laws. And she said she wants me to look beautiful. And obviously, I mean, no makeup could change her features or bring back the eye. So I said, all right, I'll help you.
In the past 5 years, almost 400 women and girls have sought out her help. She pays for reconstructive surgery, directs them into jobs. 98 have found work. There are those like Nasira, attacked because she rejected a marriage proposal, and Bashiran, horrifically burned by her mother-in-law. Bushra finds each day difficult. She says she can't forget the face that has been melted and disfigured. For her, no forgiveness, only punishment for those who do such things.
Women should not be treated like this. People should be publicly hanged. This is my heart's desire. I've even learned how to drive so that if I can see my husband walking on the street, I can kill him with my car.
And at night, she remembers how she once looked and the children she once held so close.
I can still sense my children near me. One sleeping on my left, one sleeping on my right, and my youngest son sleeping on my chest. My children are older now, but in my mind they are still small because I haven't seen them since then.
There are no accurate figures for the number of acid attacks in Pakistan each year, but it's thought only a handful are actually reported to police. There are those who see it as their right to do what they want to women. Here, they're trying to help those who are victims and change a way of thinking. Alan Fisher, Al Jazeera, Lahore.
There are many women like this all over the world who live in a world of darkness. And this is part of why I'm writing the book, Prisoner of Her Culture, to bring awareness to the very horrible way women are treated. And are the second-class citizen status is on women in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. And they are treated like this. They are treated as the possession of men, that men can lord it over women. They can't refuse sex unless they're going through their monthly menstrual or sick. This is the way of the war on women in the Middle East, oppression, the violence. And I was talking about acid attacks. Just recently, my dear friend Paymane, who lives in Malaysia as a Christian Iranian refugee, I asked her, since I was going to do this program on the war on women, I asked her a few months ago to write something profound about this. And she thought about the acid attacks of the women in Iran just a few months ago. And something must be done to make awareness of their plight too. So she wrote a fictional type of story as if she was one of the women who were attacked by acid in Iran last year. And she wrote this story to bring us awareness of what life was like or could be like for a woman who lives in this dark and frightening world after being attacked with acid. And so what I want to do right now, I want to take the time to share this latest blog that's on my Facebook page. It's entitled Confessions of an Iranian Acid Attack Victim. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He saves the crushed in spirit. Psalm 34, verse 18. I was born healthy and cute. I was a sweet baby with big, beautiful black eyes. My parents sacrificed so much money and time for my education to make my future secure. I studied very hard. Studying in Iran is not easy. It is very stressful and very expensive. Recently, the government instructed the universities to offer the majority of the degree programs to only men, depriving women of the opportunity to compete for jobs. Once again, the Iranian regime is engaging in gender discrimination, which is to be expected when living in an Islamic society. After struggling through university, I met a wonderful man and decided to get married. You should have seen me. I was a beautiful bride. My parents helped us to have our own dream home. I was very satisfied and happy. Instead of taking a government job of teaching English, I instead taught at a private institute. The government insisted that I follow all of the Islamic rules and regulations. They quizzed me about the Quran and Islam. I didn't want to be pressured by all of these regulations, so teaching at a private institute seemed much more comfortable for me. Of course, I had to wear a hijab at the institute. Wearing the veil is mandatory for women in the public workplace. I was a happy and beautiful bride. I had a great job, a great group of students, and a wonderful husband. Then suddenly, one day, my life totally changed forever. I had just rolled down the window of my car to help a motorcycle rider with directions, when suddenly I was blinded. I couldn't see. My whole face felt like 1,000 needles had punctured it all at once. It was like I was on fire. I screamed and pulled the car off the road as best as I could. My chest, arms, and hands felt like I had just climbed inside of a scorched oven. I immediately began to tear off all of my clothes. "Cover yourself. You are a woman. Don't remove your clothes in the middle of the street. There are men here," the voices of women passing by shouted at me. Did not know the attacker. I didn't even see his face. What had I done wrong to him? In just a few seconds, he had destroyed my life forever. All that my parents had done for me in more than 3 decades, he had destroyed in just a few seconds. He had taken everything that God had generously given to me. He had played God with my life. In just a few seconds, he took away my beauty, my eyesight, my future, my life. He took away everything but my breath. I wish he had killed me. Death is better than this life. I was a patient in the hospital for many long and difficult weeks. I felt like I was in hell when they removed the damaged and scarred skin from my face. I felt like they had also removed my soul, my whole being. They also took the soul of my parents and husband when they removed the ugly skin from my face. I will never be able to teach again. The children would be frightened to look at my face. There is no justice, no peace for me, no closure. The government doesn't even look for my attacker. I am scarred and humiliated for life. My beauty back again, my eyesight back again. I want to smile again. I just want to live again. I am miserable. And yet my attacker is free to enjoy his life. He can see, he can eat, he can have money. He is free to attack more women like me. My parents have spent all of their money to help me. My husband had to take out a loan, and now he can't pay it off. He is depressed and has to see a psychologist. I have to get divorced. I have to ask my husband to leave me. He has the right to a normal life. I don't expect him to suffer and burn with me. I have just one question. Why? What did I do to deserve this? What sin did I commit? I just want to know who my attacker is. Does he really feel peace now? Dear God, please help me. Please rescue me from this hell and darkness. Please beauty again from all of my pain. Amen. Thank you, dear Payman A, for Confessions of an Iranian Acid Attack Victim. I want to take the time right now to introduce to you a good, good friend. And she is very, very knowledgeable about what goes on against women in Pakistan. Her name is Raheel Raza. She's featured in the Honor Diaries documentary. And here is an interview a few years ago. She puts in perspective what I've been talking about all morning. Let's listen to her interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Wow. Now, whenever an honor killing, what a misnomer, but whenever an honor killing takes place, whenever a woman is killed by a father, brother, cousin, or even a mother in the name of religion or culture, we're told by white liberals that it has nothing to do with faith. Really? The denial is just sickening, frankly. Author Rahil Raza is a leading Islamic moderate campaigner for women's rights, and thank God she's in this country and working as hard as she does. Welcome to you, as always.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Now, just recently in the UK, it was an old case, but they found this poor girl's body, and she'd been murdered, and her mother was involved, and she just wanted to be like most other, better than most other girls. There's a decline of culture there. She simply wanted to maybe have some fun, not do anything bad, and they killed her. This is not that common, but it goes on, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, in some parts of the world, it's on the increase.
Really?
Yes.
Where would that be?
In Pakistan and in Jordan, according to UN reports, in Pakistan, there were 4,000 cases of honor killings. And they are honor killings. It's unfortunate, Michael, that we get so caught up in the semantics of the word. You know, shall we call it an honor killing or not call it an honor killing? But the understanding is that it is done in the name of honor. So it's not that we're calling the act an act of honor, but it is very dishonorable. But it is done because of the honor.
You put that very well.
Family is involved. It's not just an individual acting alone, as in the case of Aqsa Parvez. Saddest part is that the mother invited her home thinking that the father was just going to break her legs. But for a mother,
just break
her legs. And she's quoted as saying this. So it's a very sad reflection on the situation of women when we don't stand up and speak out for killing in the name of honor.
Well, people really don't. You mentioned two countries there. I mean,
yes.
I do know Jordan fairly well. That amazes me because Jordan has always been one of the more open Islamic societies. Christians up to now have not been badly treated there. It's been a more moderate government.
Let me read you what Article 340 of the Penal Code in Jordan states. It says, and I quote, "He who discovers his wife of one or one of his female relatives committing adultery and kills, wounds, or injures one of them is exempted from any penalty." So this is what is embedded in the penal code. In Pakistan, we have something called the Hudood Ordinance. And this was implemented by one of our presidents, General Zia-ul-Haq, who was very enchanted with the whole Wahhabi ideology. And so making women second and third class citizens didn't matter. Even in cases of rape, the women are the ones who are imprisoned.
Yes.
And there are more women in prisons than there are men, and some of them prefer to be in prison because it helps them escape this idea of honor killing. Because if a woman is raped, the honor of the family is lost. So some male relative takes it upon himself to revenge the honor of the family by just killing the girl. There was a story of a man who actually killed four of his daughters because one of them had dishonored the family, and he thought that the other three should also just go along with it and be killed.
This is beyond comprehension. Look, I unlike other stations, we name names here.
Yes.
Let's also be informed and reasonable. It's not exclusive to Islam. We have seen this in Sikh culture, to a degree in Hindu culture, but nothing like to the same extent. It seems to occur again and again in Islamic countries. You mentioned Pakistan and Jordan, for example. Most of the cases in this country have been with Islamic diaspora families. Is this implicit within Islam, or is it a perversion of the religion?
It is absolutely a perversion of the religion. There is nothing in the Quran that speaks about this issue of honor killings. But as you know, the radicals and the extremists have always misinterpreted and used it to their advantage. It is a way of power and control over women. But I'll tell you the extent to how this is a problem in Muslim countries. And I want to be very clear that this is not in the Quran, because the Quran says killing one human being is like killing all of humanity. Now, we look at more than 50% of the humanity of the Muslim world, where 50% of them, the women, are treated as second and third class citizens. Just yesterday, there was a news piece that in Saudi Arabia, a woman was told to have 10 lashes because she chose to drive.
The king maybe let her off. He was being very gracious.
But this is the same king who said that women could vote in 2015. And it's just a pathology, an ideology that considers women second-class citizens.
But when the king of Saudi Arabia said in a few years' time you can have the vote for frankly meaningless elections, Twitter went crazy with people, with Muslim women saying, stop this Western fantasy. You should be privileged to live in Saudi Arabia. Huge numbers of Muslim women saying, we love this place.
Well, this is what's so sad about it. I mean, here is a country, an ideology that has usurped women's rights, and all of a sudden they're giving them this little carrot to dangle at the end of a stick. I mean, freedom and equality are our God-given rights, and Islam gave us more rights. In the sense of, you know, inheritance and equality in the mosque. But these Wahhabis usurped those rights, and now they're handing them back one by one. So women are going to be allowed to vote, and how are they going to get there? They're going to drive there? They're not allowed to drive. So the next day he orders 10 lashes and then forgives. So this is a man who considers himself divinely ordained to suppress women. But coming back to the issue of honor killings, Michael, last year I went to Geneva to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. And I want to tell you what happened there. I went there with a group, which is an ethical humanist union, to table a petition in the United Nations to make honor killings an international criminal offense, mm-hmm. which it isn't in large part of the Muslim world. Well, the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Countries, they stop or block anything that has the word Islam or Muslim
in it. And that's what, 57 countries?
Majority.
Yeah.
All male. They block any petition that has the word Muslim or Islam in it. So we worded it in such a way to say that this is not exclusive to Islam and it is not a part of Islam. But here is where the problem is, that according to the law of Qisas in Sharia, which is man-made, a family member can forgive another family member and then there is no penalty on them. So for example, if a father or if a brother or a son commits an honor killing, the father can forgive them and therefore they're not put up to trial. So the tragedy in this is, of course, double. One, that the crime is being committed, but the worst tragedy is that the perpetrators of this crime are not taken to court. They're given forgiveness and under the so-called Islamic law in some countries. So obviously it has some connotations in the Muslim faith, and sooner or later Muslims have to wake up and realize that killing women is not part of the faith.
Well, inshallah. Thank you so very much indeed.
My pleasure.
A very tireless champion for the rights of women, Rahil Raza, doing everything she can to change the laws, to implement legislations to make honor killings a crime that is punishable and brought before justices and courts instead of the clause, as she pointed out, in some Islamic countries where they can just be forgiven. And that they don't face any penalties, and they don't go before a judge, and they don't suffer for their crimes. And so she, that is Rahil, is doing her best to make honor killings a crime that is punishable, that you're brought before a judge, and that you're tried and convicted, and not just given the forgiven clause. I applaud Rahil for her words and her insight and her fight for the rights of women all over the world. Well, we've heard some very, very painful stories today, from female genital mutilation to acid attacks to honor killings to forced marriages. And these are crimes that are also happening here where you and me live. Is there hope for these women that survive? Is there hope for these women that suffer from scars mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually? Well, the group Super Chick has a wonderful song. A beautiful song of hope, beauty from pain for these women. And I want you to hear it right now on the cross in the desert.
The lights go out all around me. One last candle to keep out the darkness surrounds me. I know I'm alive, but
There is hope found in Jesus, who brings beauty from the pain. And such is the story here of Heba, who was the survivor of an honor killing. She shared her story on the air. Her face was shadowed and her voice distorted to protect her identity. She explained that her family tried to murder her after discovering she had a romantic relationship with a married man. However, the scandals in her life had started long before she was capable of making adult decisions. As a child, Heba never felt safe at home in her village. Her father raped her repeatedly, and she did not feel loved. Later, she would confront her family about the abuse, but they did not believe her. There seemed to be a lot of hope for Heba when she moved out of the house and into the city for higher education. Ambitious career goals led her to study law. At the same time, she was seeking love and romantic relationships and eventually got pregnant while dating a married man who was 10 years older than her. Heba's family found out about the relationship. Her sister called on the phone to threaten her, saying, "You're going to die. We're going to kill you." The coming months would change Heba's life entirely. Someone claiming to be a wealthy suitor contacted Heba online and lured her to a meeting place where he allegedly could rent her an apartment. When her taxi approached the meeting place, another car cut it off. A man jumped out and tried to shoot her, but his gun jammed and her life was miraculously spared. There was a second attempt to target Heba, but a friend warned that she was being watched. She decided to flee the country. Heba ran away from her lone life, and soon after, into the arms of Jesus. In her new country of residence, Heba met a Christian who shared God's love. She decided to follow Christ. How does she feel about her past lifestyle? Heba says, "I pray, Lord, I come to you and consider you my Savior. I confess my sin. I ask that you resolve the matter. I don't consider my son a mistake, but rather the opposite. I want to be a servant." Heba plans to have her baby and raise her son without the help of his father, who refuses to claim him. Honor killings are common in the Middle East and North Africa, but they also occur in European countries. 5,000 women die around the world each year in honor killings. Several more have survived crimes of honor violence. Please pray for victims of honor violence to find the perfect healing and forgiveness of Christ, as Heba did. Pray for an end to honor killings. Jesus dealt with the fanatical religious leaders of his day. They were constantly trying to discredit him. They would go before his disciples in the meeting places and do things to discredit him publicly. They feared what Jesus did. They saw the miracles, and they could not discredit him on that. They knew these were real miracles. They couldn't say that they weren't. But they feared the masses. They feared the people to accept him as Messiah. And so the only way they knew to stop the madness, the crowds following Jesus, was to publicly humiliate and discredit him once and for all. And they would pit Jesus against the law of Moses, against the laws, and say, "You are not truly the Messiah or a prophet. If you were, you would never, never go against our laws." And one such incident was the story in the Bible, if you're familiar with reading the Bible, of the woman caught in adultery. Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning he was back again at the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. As he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery, put her in front of the crowd. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" You have to picture this. This was a woman that was caught in the act of adultery. I guess she had the quote-unquote four witnesses clause that had witnessed this. But Jesus doesn't dispute that this woman had been caught. But he knows their hearts. He knows what they're trying to do. He understands that they're really not concerned about the law of Moses or about God's law. What they're concerned about is to trap him and to say, "Aha, we have you, Jesus. You know the law. What do you say? This woman was caught in the act of adultery. She should be stoned." And so in their minds, they have two things going on in their mind. Number one, if Jesus says to just forgive her and walk away, then we know he's a false prophet. He will discredit himself before the crowd because he's not upholding the law of Moses. But if Jesus says, "Yes, I agree, she should be stoned," then he will lose all of his followers. These followers know him as a merciful, compassionate person, and yet he is willing to have this woman stoned. "So we have you, Jesus. Damned if you do, and damned if you don't," in their own thinking. But Jesus is much more wiser and smarter than they are. He understands what their motive is. He also knows that the man that should be here isn't here. He knows this has all been contrived. Where is the man? He should be here along with the woman. He knows their hearts. So he says to them, they were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. What was Jesus writing? Many, many theologians, many, many church fathers have really wrestled with what Jesus was doing. He stoops down with his finger and begins writing in the sand. Why? What is going on here? Many, many say that he's writing the sins of all of the accusers of this woman in the sand. He is showing how they have broken the law of God themselves. So he's writing down their sins. And that's one possibility of what Jesus was doing. But what's more important is that what he does next. All right, he looks at the crowd. But let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone. Oh, Jesus, you have caught them in their act of hypocrisy. Jesus, you are so wise and so wonderful in your thinking. You are exactly right. Look, he says, if you are without sin, then you should be the first one to stone her. And of course, this mob understood. They were convicted to the heart. They knew they were wrong. Then he stooped down and wrote in the dust again. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Imagine this. These accusers are convicted to the heart. He continues to write in the sand. And all of a sudden, this mob mentality, this demand of Jesus, it melts away. They drop their stones and they walk away. And Jesus and the woman are the only two left. You know, we have many accusers in our life, but it comes down to this. It's between you and God. When we stand before God, what will be our claim? What will we say to the holy God of the universe? And you have to picture this. There is this woman who is an adulteress standing before Jesus. Drug addicts, adulterers, lawbreakers stand before Jesus. All of us stand before him. The crowd of accusations, they have walked away. It's just between me and the Lord. And what does Jesus do? He stood up and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" And this woman, probably bowing her head in shame, said, "No, Lord." And Jesus says to the woman, "Neither do I, and sin no more." It's interesting, after this powerful, beautiful scene, Jesus speaks to the multitude and says, "I am the light of the world. If you follow me, you will have to walk. You won't have to walk in darkness, because you will have the light that leads to life." Jesus, the light of the world. The light of the world that exposes all sin and hypocrisy and untruth. The light of the world was standing before this woman. God manifested in the flesh. Her creator stood before her. He had every right to exact the law against her as an adulteress. He could have, and no one could have accused him. He is without sin. He is perfect. And the perfect, sinless Savior of the world looked at this woman, not toning down the demands of the law, but looked at her and said, "I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more." You see, for the women who were caught in the war against them, the hope is found in Jesus. There is true healing and true forgiveness in Jesus. Jesus says to the war on women, "This is wrong. This is hypocritical. This is sinful." And he says to those survivors, battered and bruised emotionally and physically, "You are forgiven. You can find hope in me. You can find healing in me. You can find life in me. I don't condemn you. I am not like the men in your life that want to control you, that want to oppress you, that want to keep you as a possession. I instead have my arms of love reached out to you and say to you, go in peace. There is no crime that I won't forgive. There is no sin that I won't forgive. You are healed. You are made whole in me." This is a beautiful story in the Bible. It's one of my favorite. When I think of this woman, I can picture her looking up with her eyes wide in astonishment. I am forgiven of my adultery. Yes, I am forgiven. And this woman dusts herself off and walks away, completely healed, completely made whole by Jesus. Heba was an honor-killing survivor, and she walked into the arms of love of Jesus and found her hope in healing. For those that listen to my program, I don't know you. Some of you I do, but many of you I don't. If you've been violated, if you've been humiliated, if you have been scarred, and you have been broken down again by men who use the Quran, by men who use their control to oppress you, to know there is hope and healing and forgiveness in Jesus. I have a page dedicated to the abused Muslim women. It's called Beyond the Veil. And you can go to this page any day. It's called Beyond the Veil. And you can find hope and healing there for many stories of Muslim women. And you can also find hope and healing from Jesus. And this is the way out of the scars and pain. This is the way to find healing. Jesus doesn't offer a Band-Aid to the problem. He offers total transformation, forgiveness, and healing. As he said to the woman caught in adultery, go and sin no more. Go. You're free. I don't condemn you. And Jesus stands before you with his arms of love held open wide to forgive and heal you. This is the Jesus that I know, the one who is fully God and fully man, who comes to forgive all of our guilt and shame and wash it away completely. He is your hope. He is your healer. And I invite you to come to my Beyond the Veil page and to find that healer on the page. I want to thank everyone today who came to my chat room. Thank you so much for listening to this very important special program on the war on women. I hope after listening to this you understand there is real war going on against women. And they live all around us, most of them in the Middle East. And I hope that you will be their voice and speak out for justice for these women. Thank you. God bless you. Have a great weekend. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert this coming Monday.
Great.